Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome. Hey, it's 2025. We're January version of Book Lovers Wairarapa. I'm Gareth Raps, and I'm here with co-host Steve Lawrence.
Hello, Gareth.
And this is our first of the year, and we've got a little looking back, but we've also got a lot of looking forward. We've also had a lot of time with the summer break for, you know, holiday reading. I hope you've been by the pool with the books and getting through those. You found us on Arrow 92.7 and Channel 41 on Wairarapa Freeview TV. I noticed there was an article on a retrospective look at Why Word, listing out all the great speakers and had that. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's been a very good thing, Wairarapa Word. Kudos entirely to Madeline Slavik. I just do what she tells me. I've got through life that way.
It is.
But we have another band of helpers as well. That's sort of morphed or changed over the decade or whatever we've been doing it. And but we've always had sufficient help to get by, and we've had some really good people.
And what is not too far away? We must have something. February we begin, or we.
Yeah, so first off the cab, off the rank for this year is Simon Burt. Now, Simon is a Masterton local, I think, but he's a regular attender at Why Word events. And he has written a book called Route 52, A Big Lump of Country Unknown. He had a book launch. It's just come out. He had a book launch at Headley's late last week.
Right. Do you go to those?
I have a lot of trouble fitting everything in my life.
Well, you are the significant counsellor and running a business, and you probably have other stuff too.
Yeah, so, we do.
Now you're excused from that.
I have to cut the hedge, but I'm trying to put that off because it's about 200 metres long. If you count both sides of it. It's probably not. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So 4 o'clock on the 9th of February, Simon will come along, and he's bringing his mate Carl Dufresne along, and they'll have a little chat. So this book is about Route 52, which it's not the same as Route 66. It's a bit further south.
But it has a ring about it.
It does. It's a road from Masterton to Waipa. And the little... promo goes, Wairarapa writer Simon Burt hooked up his camper caravan, chucked Meg the Foxy in the back seat and set off to find out what makes the back road between Masterton and Waipukarau tick. He shared beers, cuppers and scones and tales of trouble and joy with the people. Route 52, published by Deborah Coddington's Ugly Hill Press, tells his stories of isolation, joy, architecture and humour. So that should be pretty good. And I don't imagine... Everybody in the Wairarapa turned up at David Headley's the other night, although he did have more wine than we do.
So great to see local books, isn't it?
Well, we do our best. And anybody who's sort of even semi-local, we try and fit in, give them a chance to talk about what they're doing. And
it could be an interesting template for other writers to go, actually, we've got interesting geography or an interesting street, you know, so who knows what this could lead to.
I don't suppose it's a terribly entirely original idea, but it is the only book that's been written about Route 52.
And have you actually read it yet, or you'll wait till here?
I haven't got any stock yet. That's sort of
Stock. Oh, well, look, this won't be the last time we discuss this book.
No.
And a little bit of after
that. So March the 2nd, we've got Michelle Elvey coming along. Michelle's been to Wairarapa before as a writer of flash fiction, but she and Vaughan Rapatahana have edited a book called Te Moana o Reo, An Ocean of Language, which has stories in 40 different languages in it. And that's published, in fact, by Cuba Press, which is...
is that Christchurch? Local. Or is that no, London?
No, that's Martinborough.
Martinborough. Oh, well, there you go.
Wellington. Yeah, so that's on the 2nd of March. We did something vaguely similar at Wairarapa Word a few years ago. Madeline got a lot of people, maybe 25 people, to come along to Aratoi and present poems all in different languages.
Cool.
One of which was Scots, but you know. That's just a bit of rubby.
It doesn't mean no one would understand, you know, what it was anyway, but with those accents, but... Okay, that's good. Well, there it is. You've heard now about the February-March program, and yep. That will evolve through the year.
Yep. Yeah, yep. We've got it kind of mapped out, but if I tell everybody, they won't. By the time I get to December, they've forgotten about February. So.
Exactly. Okay, now I've got a book.
Which you're confident will be the book of the year.
I know, and I know it's pretty early in the year, in January, to say, like, this is it.
Yeah.
Now, it was published last year, yes. So maybe it was the book of the year last year.
Well, if you've only read it this year, then clearly
no,
not.
It is, yeah, it's, I've only read it this year, and I have been very, very excited. When the book of the year should get you excited.
Mm.
Andrew O'Hagan, he'd been nominated 3 times for the Booker. He's the editor-at-large of the London Review of Books.
Okay.
So
he should be able to get in there then.
Yeah, he's connected. He knows people. This is what I would call the big, meaty read.
Mm.
You know, it is a big book. And at the start, there is 2 pages of 60 characters. Now, that's like a Dickens novel.
Mm.
And I will admit, there's quite a bit of early on just turning to see. But they're in groups, you know, family groups or... the various, wherever they fit into the story, and they all are linked into the tale. But I, you know, I just can't stop thinking about this book. Here's the pitch. May 2021 in London. So if you, I don't know London that well. I know it a little bit, but for people, I can see why this has just been all over the charts in Britain.
Hmm.
Kelly, whatever they call the road. Campbell Flynn, art historian and celebrity pundit, is entering the empire of middle age. Fueled by an appetite for controversy and novelty, he doesn't take people half as seriously as they take themselves, which will prove the first of his huge mistakes. The second, Milo Mengasha has beguiling and provocative student. Milo inhabits a more precarious world. He has his experience and ideas that excite his teacher. He also has a plan. On the course of this incendiary year, a web of secrets and crimes will be revealed, and Campbell Flynn may not be able to protect himself from the shattering exposure of all his privilege really involves. But then he always knew when his life came tumbling down, it would occur in public. Mm. I mean, the Observer says, O'Hagan demonstrates that fiction can compel us to redefine reality. And, you know, The Guardian says, barnstorming book. I mean, I just love this. I thought this was so, so good. Little quote from Robert Louis Stevenson, which I loved right at the start. After a certain distance, every step we take in life, we find the ice growing thinner beneath our feet. And all around us and behind, we see our contemporaries going through.
Mm.
So it is going to be the story of the fall. The writing, sharp, clever, you know, just terrific. The story, it's big, loads of character. Great arc of impending doom. This guy, even all the characters are well drawn, even though there's heaps of them, you just quickly recognize them as they all fit in. This guy knows London, he knows about wealth and privilege, also student life, street life, the financial world, the legal world, the political world, very, very clever, just pouring into it. It's one of those books you're just reading it going, you know, the writing's so good, and it's just modern day London, which is, I'm not going to get into it, but it's big, big, big. All right. I don't know if I'm going to read a better book this year. I mean,
well,
there we go. I'm putting
you
this out
stop.
There. Yeah. And so, look,
I suppose the other way is it means that you've got lots and lots of books to read to try and find a better one.
It's the bar.
Yeah.
And the bar is kind of very, very high. Now, I've seen this at Elmo's. I'm looking forward to seeing if it's how the sales go. It's, to me, you know, I'm wanting to put it into everybody's hands so that we can have a good chat about it. And I hope in the course of this year, but I know you have a lot on, you know, by the side of, on your desk, but this is terrific.
One of the things I like about it, I mean, we've just come from the shop and we were talking about all those sort of pastel covers with the swirly writing on,
yes,
all looking the same. Well, I haven't got another book with a cover like that. It's very helpful for finding them.
It is. And that's, look, I know when you have a lot of stock, that's very important. Anyway, I'm ticking off Caledonian Road as in the place it deserves to be, but what have we got over there that perhaps...
Well, you've probably talked about this late last year, but
I've read it, so maybe I have, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the latest Michael Connelly, which came out in October, but... So Harry Bosch is his main claim to fame, but these now it's the René Ballard and Harry Bosch, and the main character is really René.
For real, yep.
And Harry just helps sometimes.
Yeah. Great hook.
Yeah.
You know, her losing her badge and her shield or something, which seems to be so important to, you know, show to people that you are the law.
Yeah. Lost a badge and a gun.
And a gun. And then beginning to unpack it and then what it leads to.
Yeah.
So LA. You know, it's on Santa Monica Beach. It's just, you know, it's a place I know well. And I love Connolly.
Yeah.
And,
I thought this was really well constructed because there's three stories, there's three crimes, if you like.
Yeah.
One of which is a whole bunch of crimes that she works her way through. Another one is brought to her by Harry's daughter.
That's right, yep.
Who, because she's running a cold case
division. That's right, she's been brought in as a young trainee policewoman. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's a policewoman and she volunteers to work for René in this cold case.
And involves Dad.
Because she thinks she's solved the great mystery of, or the unsolved crime in LA history, which is the Black Orchid.
The Black Dahlia, is it?
Black Dahlia,
yeah.
And then there's another story which runs through it where a number of unsolved rapes.
Yep.
Are
linked into it.
Linked because they find someone, a DNA thread. And that's really intriguing because...
And that's very popular now. There are a couple of Netflix shows on that using that in police detection.
Because the DNA leads to a very prominent person through the hereditary...
And that's all twisty and that's...
Because it turns out that the link is not what you think it is. No,
I think they're excellent. And I saw a review on one the other day with him talking about how his next one will include the fires because that's such a historic moment in LA's, life as a city.
Yeah.
So can't wait.
Yeah.
He writes at such a high standard.
Yeah. It's because there's so much going on in this book, it's a real can't put down because if you get bored with one story, there's another one going on at the same time.
No one gets bored with René, and she's a terrific protagonist and on the case and facing all the you know, being a woman in the police force, all the issues that has, and
politics about
the politics of the police department, yeah. Which, you know, he must have terrific friends to hear all the stories and to embed them in the story, because it feels so right and so real.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's The Waiting, Michael Connelly.
All right, I'm going to match it with a crime, an English one. And it's a little series. It's A Killing in November by Simon Mason. And there are three of these now, and this is the first. And often it's you find it by first seeing the third one, and you're going, well, I want to know how it began, and maybe I won't even like it. But if I begin with the first one, which I often reckon all the work goes in to make it a goodie, Killing in November, a double murder case for Oxford's D.I. Wilkins. All right, now, which is a little kind of joke for you, which I realise now. Mick Herron loved it. And I really rate him. I see he got a big award for a crime writer of the, you know, century or something. Mm. I mean, something big. And he says, this is a terrific crime novel with a startling original protagonist. We're going to see a lot more of Oxford's mean streets. Just got meaner. Now, I didn't even know there were mean streets in Oxford. It always seemed
like dreaming spires.
Yeah, it? Like a really affluent little thing. But apparently it's got mean streets. Simon Mason made his name with young adult books and won prizes, and he was also a publisher, probably published his own work, but, you know, it was very, yeah. And won lots of prizes. So he decided to launch in to do how it'd go for an adult one, and terrific, here's the hook. Ryan Wilkins grew up on a trailer park, a member of what many people would call the criminal classes. As a young detective inspector, he's lost none of his disgust with privileged elites or his objectionable manners. But he noticed things. They stick in his eyes. His professional partner, D.I. Ray Wilkins, of affluent Nigerian London heritage, is an impeccably groomed, smooth-talking graduate of Baloi. Is it Baloi? How you say it? B-A-L-L-I?
Oh, no, that'll be...
I-O-I?
It's Baloi something, isn't it? I've never known
Oxford.
It. It's French, but...
You'd think they wouldn't get on, and they don't. All right. But when a young woman is found strangled in Barnabas's hall, they're forced to. It introduces an unlikely duo of different sides of the tracks in Oxford's in a deftly plotted murder story, full of dangerous turns, troubled pasts, and unconventional police works. I liked it. I thought this is, you know, it's a huge, crowded field.
It's very, very, very crowded.
Yeah, and I know you can't stock everything, but... I've found something, and I did enjoy it. Ryan and Raymond, I mean, it's a good case of the wrong detective being set and what the mayhem that follows. And he's a true wild card, quirky, you know, detective. It's certainly one to keep an eye out for those people out there who love a crime book.
But it's challenging because there are so many.
Who's going to stock them all? But there is also, there's a many because there's a great readership.
There is, but and people like the writers that they like and they like the detectives that they like.
Yeah. And that's why people come to them.
It's a bit of an effort to get them to say, I think you'd like this one.
I know, but that's why our show is, you know, reaches beyond Elmo sometimes to say, look, this is okay.
Well, reaches beyond Elmo all the time.
But now, on the top of Pilots, I see a
I'm going to have a go at this, because I don't know if we're going to be able to get this camera to work in terms of getting it to look at this book. And if it doesn't, then I'm wasting my breath. But I quite like this. This is the... Oh, here we go. So this is a... I'll grab it where I can. This is a self-help book, and it's the best self-help book of the year, and it's...
Hey, we've got everything. It's the best... And it's only January.
Help yourself to what you want. So this is advice from Kias, and it's really a photographic book because they are, but they don't mind getting their picture taken. Take time out for play, it says, and they're having a quiet moment. It says, Be Bold. I don't know if you can see that one. This is very bold. It's got a head actually inside the car, demanding new keys. And there's one here that says, this is good advice, bend over backwards if you have to. Now, that thing's got a mind of its own, so no one's going to see this, but it's...
And there are some also more, you know, some ideas and thoughts. They're not just, are they not all big pictures, or are they?
I think they've...
Oh, no, so they look like it's consistently, you know, yeah, little aphorisms and fun little one-liners.
Yeah.
Now, you're not a great self-help kind of promoter, but that's obviously caught your attention.
I just thought it was quite funny, as I think most self-help books are in the end.
Hey, look, if it catches your attention, you heard about it here first. I've never seen a review or anything about it, so and I've certainly made a note of it.
Life advice from the world's smartest bird, it says.
Yeah, no, anybody who's had their car attacks, you know, down at Haast knows all about these guys. You know, the... We've done a little, that takes us into the world of nonfiction, and I have a heavier book, Nexus.
Yes.
Now, Nexus is, apparently, according to Mustafa Suleiman, says, masterful and provocative. Yuval Noah Harari?
Yep.
Okay. Now, he wrote Sapiens.
Sapiens and Homo Deus.
Right, and I noticed that you have two of his biggest books down there as graphic novels.
Yes.
How are they going?
Oh, good. So we've got them again. We've sold them through. But they do make big ideas. I mean, he makes big ideas accessible because he's a really nice writer, apart from being obviously a smart guy. He's a really nice writer. So it's all quite accessible. And the graphic novels just take that to another level.
I've read them both. I read them when the books came out, and then I like the graphic novels are like a great reread.
Yeah, it was a big discourse on money and what money is. I mean, I think that's quite topical in terms of, you know, cryptocurrencies. Are they money? Well, not possibly. You can't really spend them.
It's swirling around us now.
Yeah, but also he starts off with, I think, somewhere a billion years ago and somewhere, or 4,000 years ago, where money was fundamentally grain.
Okay. This is in Sapiens, yeah.
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 But it means if you had to leave in a hurry with all of your money, you needed a wagon train.
Right. It sounds like James A. Michener, you know, all his books would start with, you know, the dinosaurs roaming around the pages and you know, bring us up. But Nexus... Now, Nexus is getting a bit of attention. It's a brief history of information networks from the Stone Age, which is like what he likes to do, to AI. It's very interesting. And he takes the idea of stories, books, internet, algorithms, and asks the question, where are these all evolving to? And AI, what is it doing with those things? He's a public intellectual. Now, we don't have lots of these people, but these people have cut through all the people out there to actually get their books out there and their messages.
Hmm.
I mean, because he is, you know, he is a historian of note now. It's original, it's provocative, and I found... It affects your thinking about AI. At one stage, when you read it, you kind of find, this is really thrilling. This is incredibly exciting, but also taking thrilling and flipping. It's also underneath it. It's kind of chilling.
It's extraordinarily chilling. If you've ever seen the Terminator movies,
yeah. Well, and he takes that. Actually, he's very good on
Skynet coming to get you.
Yeah,
I believe all this stuff. I'm worried about all that stuff.
Yeah, he's kind of like takes what, you know. Details and goes, these are kind of mega trends. It made me think Toffler, you know, Future Shock, back in the day.
Should reread it, see if he was right.
Right, but yeah, he did the same thing, going like, you know, here are trends beneath the, a little bit beneath the surface, and this is our current version of these. Well-reasoned. I do hope our political leaders will read this sort of book. It is...
They're silly if they don't.
No, it is... I mean, there's a little exercise here about if AI took the idea, you know, as a thought experiment, you know, one of those things, and they said if they decided, you know, the AI, that they would become, the world would get dedicated to making paper clips, and how, you know, they would eventually capture, the whole world would be in the business of making paper clips, and then they'd realise they needed...
Some paper.
Well, no, they would need to, you know, colonise planets because they needed... you know, more resources, and how eventually the whole universe becomes, you know, focused on producing paper. You know, it was a great thought experiment and very entertaining.
See, just to show how up to date we are, I'm going to struggle to remember the name of this thing, but you know that, or you may not, that NVIDIA, who make the AI chips, their share price went from $20 to $240 in 2 years or something.
Right.
And people were busy. Some organisation is refitting the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant to create enough energy to run the data centres that are going to be required. And then overnight, this thing, something rather secret, I can't remember its name. Anyway, it's a Chinese firm, have come up with an AI chip and software and all the rest of it, which is significantly better than anything else, and they've only spent $5.6 million doing it. And overnight, this is world record, NVIDIA's share price, or the capitalization, dropped $1 trillion.
That's a big number.
That's a very big number. Big enough to affect the price of gold, because people are going to be selling their gold to pay the margin calls on their NVIDIA shares, and it's...
Watch the space. I know, I picked it this morning, that was scrolling through, and it's...
So the, I guess what I'm saying is that there's such a big bet on AI, and I personally, the only experience I've had with it, is it wants to write my bloody emails for me. And it really annoys me.
This Nexus is a historical long lens on just the issues that you're putting up. Underlying it is there's this big question that you just start thinking about it, and you can't stop thinking about it when you're reading it. Go, why are we so self-destructive as a species?
So this is the perfect time for you to read your poem.
Oh, that's the story. Okay, hold on. And how do we find our shared humanity? Is the message, you know? Which is terrifically good to have that. But I would. If you liked Sapiens, I totally point you at this. It's had a bit of mixed reviewing, and it's such a controversial field. There's a lot of people have angled in on it, but it just makes it more topical.
Because it's now and in the future, so everybody's as an...
Everyone's got an
opinion. No one really knows yet whether he's right or wrong, whereas Sapiens, you can sort of, well, clearly that's what happened.
Right. Now We'll save the poem for a second.
Because it's right on topic.
Well, what you could tell me, or tell our listeners and viewers, why am I about going reading this poem?
Because I had an altercation with the dog on Norfolk Road.
And?
It died.
It died. I mean, I got to know about this.
I didn't shoot it because I sort of... We ran into it.
We met up, and there your car was
a bit mangled,
a bit damaged, and you weren't happy on lots of levels.
Well, I didn't want to hurt the dog, but I had no choice.
I know.
It was just there.
So, Eric Kennedy, in his little book on Such a Lovely Day Indoors, had a little poem about this, and it was called The Autonomous Vehicle Research Centre. There's only one really serious philosophical question, and that is, do self-driving cars break for animals? And the answer is mostly no, not unless it might damage the vehicle, depreciating the asset and taking up time. And it occurs to us the really serious philosophical counter-argument is the regiments of exploding squirrels, hedgehogs fashioned of filed tungsten, foxes that release flaming napalm, that's it, when burst on the road. To teach the algorithm that cars should have slowed right down to the speed of life. Because you can teach a car anything you want. These days a car can grow up to be a model citizen with a fear of the vengeance of small things and a healthy concern for all that is concerning. This is what we call deep learning. So, you know, that was prompted, by your very, very sad story.
But it is about AI.
It is.
And as I said before, if you teach your car to watch out for squirrels or possums.
Possums are probably more.
Yeah. Mind you, we need to get rid of the possums, so I'm not worried about that. Cats. Let's say cats. Or people dogs. Say that you need to get rid of them. Anyway, dogs for sure. No one wants to run over dogs.
No.
Especially not me anymore.
Well, you never have.
But if your car is programmed to never run over the dog, does that mean it has to make an instant decision between the dog and the oncoming vehicle on the other side of the road?
Yeah.
And how do you...
The greater of lesser evils. Yeah. And that's where the algorithm...
Maybe the new Chinese system will enable it to work.
It is an interesting question.
But it is the future of public transport. Self-driving.
Right.
Just, you know...
And they probably won't be...
Dial one up, the little chain of these things all treading down the middle of the road or something, and then you're 15 blocks away and you're looking for a bus, so you just put something in your phone and one of these things will come and get you, take you wherever you want to go. And the algorithm will work out the most efficient, which of these units has how many people going where, and it'll work out the most efficient way to do it. And there'll be no more buses, no more trains.
As a sideline, driving here, I passed a Masterton taxi, which I've never seen before. There it was, which fits into our moving people around. But moving on now, Joe Bennett has told us what?
Well, 2003, Joe wrote a book called A Land of Two Halves, which is, you know, obviously some sort of nod to the game of two halves that people keep talking about. In fact, there was a TV program about that very thing. And it's about 2003, hitchhiking around New Zealand and the various places that he turned up in. It's just been republished with some new chapters for some places that he never got to.
Which probably indicates that it sold well back in the day and it's worth giving it a pump.
Well, it is. I mean, a couple of reasons. One is not that much has changed in terms of the people and places and stuff, right. But quite a lot's changed. And it's interesting to see, because he wasn't born here. He rocked up in about 1980 or something from the UK. And when he did this little trip around, he'd been here 20 years. Well, now he's been here 40.
But he was known as a columnist.
Yeah.
And he has great company in those columns. Mm. And as a compassionate and engaging writer. So I can... And he's written quite a few books. Which a lot of them have been sort of collections of his columns.
Yep. And I imagine... I don't know for a fact, but I guess this probably was as well.
I had a quick glance through it and I went, no, this is a different style, whether he's just been collecting these tales.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's been revised, I like, and the fact that there are new bits to it. And once again, it's our Kiwi book.
Hmm. There's one little bit, I thought this was quite cute, about this, he's in a pub. Someone, I'm quite sure where this was, but and the All Blacks were playing on the telly and he's watching the TV like everybody else is, and there's this, I think she's Canadian or something, some woman who has no idea what's going on, and she asks him to explain and he says shh, and then at halftime they have a little chat and then afterwards she says, do you play pool? And he says, no, not really. And she said, I do. I love it. I'm bloody good. And in the end, they have a game of pool. And so they wander out to where the pool tables are. I'll just read you this little bit. Shaven-headed Maori boys lounge against the walls, drinking lion red from the bottle, sunglasses propped on their scalps. On my own, I'd feel uneasy here. I'm twice the age of all of them, and half the size of many. My companion picks the roughest-looking table and lays a coin on the cushion. 10 minutes later, we're playing doubles against a pair of hoods. I'm no good at pool. The English girl's an addict. She chalks her cue fastidiously. She leans over the table till the cue butt's rubbing the cleft of her chin, and she misses every shot. I sink quite a few. I rather enjoy myself. But we both play English pool. We weigh up the shots, we aim for snookers, we hit the ball softly, we're cautious. The Maori boys take half a second to size up a shot and then give it a smack. They thrash us.
That didn't go where I expected. That is good.
Yeah. It's just a...
It's a Kiwi classic. And
that's kind of, you could kind of imagine that.
Yeah, no, I did not expect it to end like that. But hey, now we're on a roll here with New Zealand books.
Yep.
Now, I'm holding in my hand Hastings,
yep.
A Boy's Own Adventure, a memoir by Dick Frizzell. Now, this was an advanced...
It's still not out, but it's coming soon.
Right, and... got to admire the heft and the production values of it.
Mm.
Nice feeling book.
We're getting more little hardbacks.
And there's Dick on his dad's motorbike. and we all know Dick Frizzell. I mean, to me, he's probably my favourite, you know, Kiwi artist, you know, who's still alive and still doing stuff. Not seen quite so much stuff from him recently, but...
He's busy writing books.
He's into writing memoirs. Now, and this is his childhood in Hastings. Now, and the title there, I mean, that's, you know, that's obviously signalling where it is. And it's a love letter.
Mm.
It's a love letter to Hastings, and it's a love letter to what it's like to be growing up in the
50s.
50s and 60s,
yeah.
in the fabulous Hastings. Target audience, me.
Yeah, and me.
Yeah, I'm the age demographic, and the things he writes about absolutely resonate. You know, about a mate, and it's the best of memoirs. You know, a Kiwi one where it stops and makes you think of the similar sort of things that you were experiencing.
Except we, I don't think, would now be able to just get a 3-hour and see if we could shoot fish in barrels.
No, it's, which is, we'll get to that, yeah. Published by Massey University Press. He's good company.
Hmm.
He's memory. He says, it takes a lot of fiction to write non-fiction. You know, the idea that, he's got the idea of what happened, and then, like, he just kind of imaginatively fills in the gaps.
And who's going to know?
I know. He sets the frame up of a situation and then colours it in. There's not a lot of art in this. There's, like, one on, let me just go, which, in fact, there's two bits of art. There's one here, a little line drawing of a TD2. Was 2D the ice block back ice in the block, day?
TD2s, for some reason or other.
Yeah.
I can't remember why.
And it goes, excitement on a stick. and who doesn't, you know, I can remember eating those ice blocks flat out. But each chapter begins with a photo from his life, and which is okay, but I would have loved a little bit more art in it. That's what he does, and that's what he's good at. I prefer him as an artist to being a writer, and he wrote a book called It's All About the Image, 2011, which, you know, stuck with me as being a really good mix, but it was all about his art.
Well, he also wrote that book, which I really like, full of old masters, all of which he'd painted himself.
Right.
And you couldn't really tell the difference.
I know, that's right. He was with his son, who was also an artist, and they were in Europe looking at it.
Well, there's that great moment where his son is a stage designer or something, and they were in the Sistine Chapel looking at the ceiling, and his son's doing this sort of thing, saying, I reckon I could have done that.
But this book is beautiful for making us remember all the little kids' games and toys we used to do, what we used to eat, what we did for entertainment, you know, your buddies and your pals and the mischief you got up to, the innocence of it, discovering girls and just, you know, they were just such a different species. And
that hasn't changed.
Yeah, and
some things have changed, but that hasn't.
Dick is struggling to, you know, handle that. But it's... nice little book, and I think it's going to definitely find an audience like Joe Bennett's. It's becoming more and more impressive, the amount of New Zealand books that are out there, good ones. So well done, Dick, and also
I think well done to Massey University Press. I think their managing editor or the person who runs it or whatever came from Random House. I think at the time the Penguin took them over, and rather than soldier on in the great corporate ethos, she turned up at Massey, and they've published some really nice stuff.
Yeah, because it's...
Of the university presses, they're almost the most commercial.
I wonder if he is a alumni.
Could have gone to
Massey. That would be the link.
Yeah.
Supporting their alumni.
Yeah.
It's not mentioned in the book anymore.
No, well, that sort of stops before he goes to university, doesn't it? Almost. Can't
almost,
remember.
Yeah. We're cracking through here. Our next book is... Now, this has got me excited.
Okay. So this is A Divine Fury, written by... it's there somewhere, bloody thing. There we go. Nice cover. Good colour. That sort of mauvey.
They're consistent with the lettering and the style, aren't they?
But again, not many other books covers that colour, so it's another one that you can find.
Is this the third?
This is his fourth book.
This is the fourth. Okay.
So this is the fourth of the Cesare Oldo Florentine detective-y crime thrillers.
Investigator.
Yeah.
Of the time.
Yeah. So
historical crime. Would that sum it up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also a real... In the same way that C.J. Sansom gave us a pretty good picture of...
Tudor England.
Tudor England and what it was actually like when Henry was king and how you'd be bloody careful what you said to anybody, otherwise... You're going to get a bit toasty.
Sounds like Trump America.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So this is gives you a pretty good picture of what Florence was like and how the police forces were disorganised.
I love the first three. Cesare is a great, you know, his moral position on the life of a corrupt city and all the power plays behind it. And who doesn't love it? A bit of, you know, sword fighting, you know, running, dashing around the streets, trying to solve crimes.
Yeah. So this is it's not a new... Well, I suppose it is a new series. The first three were fundamentally about the same set of circumstances. They all stood alone pretty well, but there was that thread running through them.
It was a big arc, yeah.
Yeah. And at the end, all the people who were involved in that were dead.
Yep.
So he started again with a... new set of circumstances. I'd read you the back, but...
Yeah.
Chasing a suspect in the rain, Aldo discovers a horrifying scene beneath Michelangelo's statue of David. Lifeless eyes gaze from the face of a man whose body has been posed as if crucified. It's clear the killer had religious motives. More bodies appear. It's interesting. Anyway, first-class historical thriller, David Baldacci.
I will certainly have that. That's just my perfect winter read, you know, just tucked up with it'll be an engaging tale with plenty of momentum.
Yeah.
And
good characters and just a whole different setting. But
I know. Well, you and I are fans, so...
It hasn't really taken off to the extent that it could or should, but eventually it'll turn up on the telly and then everybody will want to read it, so...
Actually, it would make good television.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he...
It's Game, of, Bishop, Game David of Thrones, Bishop. You know, that sort of...
Yeah.
Back in the day.
He is a... he came from a screenwriting background.
I'm up to book five of Sansom's, you know, eight.
I think there's eight, yeah.
Tomblands, it looks like. The books are getting bigger and bigger.
Well, Tombland, I struggle with a little bit because I think there's at least 200 pages in there that didn't need to be there.
Don't tell me. I'm up to book five and we're jumping ahead. Yeah. But
the others were all really well paced and that one just seemed to... meander a bit in the middle.
Well, he died at the end of it, didn't he? No, not the character, but our...
Sansom, yeah.
Sansom is... Yeah.
Well, not at the end of it, but he was ill at the time, and he subsequently died.
Anyway, I'll report on the end of that series, which will probably take me another year, but we'll get to it.
Yeah.
Looking back a little bit at last year, I wanted to introduce the idea of what happened on our cookbook scene.
Right.
And... Recipes for Success was, you know, I think the title here. The top book. It's like a test.
Recipe to Neats.
No. Tasty by Chelsea Winter.
Oh, that was at the end of the year. Yeah.
I'm looking at Nielsen's book scan.
Yeah.
So this is an article that looked at that, you know, and I'm just sitting there. Tasty sold 7,000 copies in New Zealand.
Mm.
Outstanding.
Nothing like it used to. Well, Chelsea Winters.
She had a book.
Annabelle Langbein's.
Super Good or something?
Yeah.
Back, that was 4 years ago.
Yeah, so not that long ago, but it was the previous one, yeah.
And that was big. Mm. The next two were Nagi, Tonight and Dinner.
Yeah.
Of which both I have bought from your shop, were two and three, and they between the two of them they've sold like 8,000 copies in New Zealand.
Mm.
But Dinner, now which ones came first? Oh yeah, Dinner came first. That sold 500,000 copies. That's in Australia, and the latest one to date has sold 80,000 tonight. Mm. Huge numbers.
We don't get her on the telly, I don't think.
Well, Gail gets her emailed recipe and she, you know, they're talking to each other, you know, like woman to woman. It's a kind of, there's a huge social media thing that's picked up. Anyway, it's been a good year for cookbooks.
But the good news is the golden retriever, wasn't it? Dozer. He pulled through, apparently got a bit sick. So
that was huge. Gail was sending, you know, sort of notes about that.
Because he's the star of the show.
Well, the star of the show is the all-purpose make-it-yourself sauce called Charlie. That's the star of the show. That's why we always have a jar of that in the fridge. That's, you know, that's your go-to. More Salad by Marg Flanagan and Rosa Power, something or other. That was coming in New Zealand book. Yeah. The more plant-based.
That's the overwhelming, not exactly a trend, it's kind of here.
Yeah, well, Tasty.
Chelsea, that's all she does now, plant-based stuff, which is why I thought the Nagi ones were more useful for most people.
Yeah, well, their emphasis is more on big flavours, comfort food, wholesome food, but not necessarily the most healthy food, but... You know, just I love the Nagi. I can't get enough. Otolinghi and Jamie Oliver, way down the list. Otolinghi, seventh. I notice you've got that, and you have a range of Jamie Olivers.
Yeah, and we have a range of Otolinghis as well.
Yeah.
And the other one, which we sold reasonably well, is a Rick Stein, who still carries a bit of weight. I'm not sure if he's on the list, but.
They do well at Christmas. They're great Christmas books. So
our biggest selling cookbooks. I have to get some more actually. Lyndon Duncan from Taupo's World's Easiest Recipes,
which we have given to all our grandchildren.
Yeah,
we have bought multiple copies of all of them, and they report back, as they should, that they use them.
Because it's easy.
It's easy, and they're like university students, and you know that's their go-to. They don't need Otto, Otto Lengi. What's sold in 2024? The Reading the Room. Now, these are notes I took from a recent listener article. They say it was quieter than 23 last year overall.
For books in general?
It just says quieter.
But for books, books in general, you're
books
talking
in general, yeah. And there was, you know, there was like Burnham Wood and Axman's
Carnival,
and Lioness by Emily Perkins, which I think were in 23. But there, in 2024, we had Carl Schuker, and we had Damien Wilkins's new one. Yeah. How's that going? Delicious.
Yeah, quite well. And what the hell am I? Oh, the Katarina, the new Becky Manor 2.
Right, yeah. Tina Macariti.
Yeah.
And we had new collections from Patricia Grace and Owen Marshall, which I've heard, Owen Marshall I've heard is excellent. That, our book club may pick that up down the trail a bit.
Short stories.
Yeah. Is it the economic downturn? Or, you know, and the fact New Zealand feels sometimes it's doing a little bit of hard, where the sales may not have boomed away and are kind of plateaued a little bit?
Possibly, but COVID was good to the book trade.
Right.
Because everybody had to stay home and they read all the books that they had on their bookshelves again, and then rediscovered some authors. And book sales went really well after COVID. And then they tailed off again a bit last year.
That was worldwide, I think. What?
I don't care about the rest of the world. I only care about Carterton, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's like Trump. I only care about America. But, you know, it's...
easy for him to say that.
There was an international study that was in this listener article, and it said 40% of New Zealanders rate reading as a hobby. And it, of all the 18 countries in the... in the survey, we were number one. People regard it as a good, serious hobby. Most they averaged out about 34%, but we, top of the pops.
That's because our television's so awful.
But he also argued that we probably bought more but read less. I don't know how they get that.
No one's going to fess up to that.
No, it's a good little bit of research, because no one, you know. We buy in physical shops rather than the other 18 countries.
Yep.
We do support our bookshops,
yep.
Which is great. Audiobooks, 35 to 54 age group, are big into that. And their argument is that they're busy people. It's their big working time in their life and parenting and their reading.
And terrible traffic in Auckland and Wellington now. You've got to be doing something while you're sitting in the car.
Let's not go into Wellington's traffic. Sales are a little bit down, about 4%. And New Zealand published books dropped by about 7% last year.
That's just a title-by-title thing, I think.
Yeah. But it said fiction continues to grow year on year. That just keeps booming away. Is it escapism because of just global... bloody nuttiness?
No, I think we are less culturally cringed about reading stuff about New Zealand than we perhaps were 10, 15 years ago. And there are New Zealand authors who stand up pretty well, and we like them. And Christina Sanders is one of my... some woman we sell really well. She's been to Y Word. Nice woman.
They argue, you know, the good news is genre fiction is really healthy and moving. And it quoted these books. It said the Bookshop Detectives, you know, Gareth and Louise Wards, they said, doing really well.
From Wardini and Havelock.
Yeah.
So they should know about bookshops.
Monty Suter's two books. Gangster Paradise. Jared Savage, they mentioned that.
Well, that's not fiction.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
I don't think.
No, these are actually these are the big sellers of the Big Five, and the walks across Aotearoa.
Yeah, well, that's clearly not fiction either.
No. I think they now just moved on to the Big Five.
So, we've always sold those sorts of books.
Yeah.
There's a really nice one about, I think it's called Wild Wellington, about wildlife and nature and walking around Wellington. It's a nice book.
I haven't read that. Hannah Rose Watts. The Final Diagnosis.
That's Cedric Tempe, isn't it? Yeah.
Tempe Camp, is it, or something like
that?
But the bestseller?
As a pathologist,
That sold the most? That's the big question we're going to end the show on soon. According to BookScan...
Yeah, well, it would be right, because every bookseller hooks their sales in.
Yeah, I'll put you out of your misery here, because I'm sure you've sold plenty of it. The Last Secret Agent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Pippa Latour and
Jude. Written by Jude Dobson, yeah.
Yeah. I did not know that. We've not talked about this on the show.
I did. I must have
You
done.
Did?
Yeah. Because it's an amazing story.
So I should read that?
Yeah.
All right, look, I'll put it on the list.
Because it's a story of this woman who died at age 103, having been an SOE agent in France.
Yeah.
During the war, and she lived in Auckland from 1959 onwards. No one knew. The SAS guys did, because they went around every year and tidied up a garden. She lived out at Funilopai or Helensville or something. But otherwise, she was completely anonymous until Jude Dobson had a chat with her when she was 101. Said,
Let's get the story out. You want to hazard at a guess at how many copies have sold in New Zealand?
I don't know, 8,000 or 9,000.
You're so good at this stuff.
Mm.
9,000.
Mm.
I mean, that. You heard it here. This man knows his books.
Well, I just know also that if that's the biggest selling book in New Zealand last year, and it sold 9,000 copies, most books, there are not a lot of copies of most books sold. And we are talking print runs of 1,000 to 5,000 for most books, even even the big book.
Anyway, here we are on the cusp of 2025, looking towards a terrific year of books in front of us. You seem to have terrific new interesting stock every time I go in there. So, I am pitching that Wairarapa should visit our terrific independent bookshops, especially Elmo's in Carlton. Meet Steve, who wants to talk to you with his friendly staff, and explore the world that we just love so much. So we look forward to meeting you in February. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.